Okay, hi and welcome back to the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. This is episode 64 and this podcast is sponsored by Healthspan Elite. More details at the end of the podcast. So again, I am very pleased to welcome another great Canadian that I know. So welcome to the podcast, Nancy.
Thanks for having me, Laurent. Happy to be here.
Well, so Nancy, I'll let you tell everyone more about you in a second. But I've met you before, of course, at the ISSN conference, and we've sort of had some banter over social media and various other things. And we're both very similar insofar as we're both practitioner researchers. I know you're doing your PhD, and you can tell us about that in a second. But primarily, you're a sports nutrition practitioner, a dietitian, and your particular area of interest is in nutrigenomics, which is going to be the focus of today's podcast. So let's just kick things off quickly then. Why don't you just tell the listeners a bit more about yourself and your practice and your research interests?
Sure, absolutely. So I'll soon be entering my fourth year of the PhD program at the University of Toronto in nutritional sciences. And my research is studying nutrition, particularly caffeine, genetics, and athletic performance. And this is with a randomized control trial of over 100 athletes. So although I've been in Toronto for the past 8 years, I am from Vancouver, which gained its spot on the map, of course, with the Vancouver 2010 Olympics. And so I did most of my education at the University of British Columbia. And as you mentioned, I am a registered dietitian specializing in sport nutrition, a personal trainer, as well as a certified strength and conditioning specialist, which, of course, helps me when prescribing diets and being able to understand really what the training demands are. Yeah. And I've been in the industry for almost 20 years, so aging myself there. And I did start a personal training business way back, I guess about 18, 19 years ago, and realized that as mini trainers, I was giving out nutrition information that really wasn't so accurate. And that's what inspired me to go back to school. And so I've been basically working with athletes of all levels for the past 15 or so years. And then got involved in this research in nutrigenomics, which is very exciting, and I really feel it's going to play a big role in the future.
Absolutely, and you know, I find all this stuff fascinating, and particularly nutrigenomics. It's not an area I would consider a strength of mine, but it is an area I'm very interested in, partly because one of my things is very much about the acknowledgement of the individual. In fact, that's an area, as I was just telling you offline, is something I explore in my own professional doctorate, is this business of the individual and their relationship with the practitioner and how each affects each other and the outcomes of their interventions. And it's all very fascinating. And one thing that I've harped on a lot throughout this podcast, and so have many of the guests, is this concept of individual variability. And, you know, I know that there's all kinds of things that differentiate us and our likes and dislikes and personalities and financial circumstances and goals and outcomes, people that we interact with. But of course, you have to accept that a huge factor is going to be our own genetics. And this has become a really topical area. It's another one which is becoming shrouded, I guess, with a bunch of pseudoscience and the facts are being manipulated potentially, you know, more for financial gain or commercial gain. You know, it's the usual issue of how the science is translated into what we take to influence our own practice. And you know, a lot of that goes down the business of promoting nutritional plans, exercise plans, and supplements, and so on, and we're going to get into that in today's podcast. But you know, a lot of people do tend to sit into camps of, you know, it's all fantastic, and a bunch will say it's a bunch of rubbish. And I remember having a conversation with Stu Phillips, one of your countrymen up there in, over there in Canada, when he was lecturing for us over here in the UK on the ISSN diploma program. And I sort of asked him about this whole idea of genetics and so on. And, you know, this idea that you hear about came up, which is, you know, how genetics... it's going to go out of my head, isn't it? How genetics influences everything, sound like an idiot now. So, genetics loads the gun, but lifestyle pulls the trigger.
Yeah, the environment pulls the trigger.
That's right. That's it. You got it right. Yeah. So, genetics loads the gun. Environment pulls the trigger. He was saying, we could take it further and say, well, it depends where you aim the gun, and I love that. And then I mentioned this to someone else, and then they were like, well, it depends on the bullet that you've got in the gun, and then it depends on the trajectory of it, and so on. But of course, it does bring us back to how complex genetics is, but also how much it can influence everything. And I think that it is something that we should consider. But how much we should consider it and what the actual relevance of it is as we should take it as practitioners and consumers is what I wanted to talk to you about today. So,
sure.
So whilst I'll allow my brain to recover, why don't you just give us a bit of background as to what nutrigenomics is, because people would have heard different terms that sound similar.
Sure. Well, just to bring us back to Stu's analogy, that's a little bit more about gene expression, so epigenetics or the environment-gene interactions. And so nutrigenomics is a little bit different. So these are where genetics is a very broad field, and nutrition researchers are focusing on nutrigenomics, which is basically nutrient-gene interactions. So this is on one hand how a nutrient can affect gene expression, and on the other hand, it's how genetic variations affect our response to a nutrient, a beverage, a supplement, or any other bioactive substance in the diet. And it can affect this by a change in absorption, metabolism, elimination, or other biological effects. So it's long been realized that a one-size-fits-all model to dietary advice is based on an average response of a population, for example, and it might not be relevant to certain individuals. So we're trying to take into account these genetic differences that will affect a certain outcome. And just if you want me to go through sort of a couple of definitions.
Please do, yeah.
So the term genetic variation genotype or SNP are used interchangeably. And what a SNP is a single nucleotide polymorphism. And I know that gets quite scientific. We'll just keep it at the term SNP. And what that is basically a difference in just one letter on your genome. So if you remember from biology, a DNA strand is a double helix, and they're joined by nucleotides where a C or cytosine goes with a G or guanine. So C and G go together, and then the A and T go together. So if we have one difference in those letters, that can actually have a dramatic effect on phenotype. And it can be anything from eye color to the metabolism of vitamin C, or whether you're a fast or slow metabolizer of caffeine. So there can be certainly significant effects that are affecting your response to your diet. And this is what we want to find out more about. And a simple example would be something like lactose intolerance, where we see that there's genetic differences in the persistence of the lactase gene. And of course, we have this with gluten and many other nutrients that are affecting our health. And from caffeine sensitivity to salt sensitivity. And so it really goes on and on. And I sort of look at this as we basically have a unique response to our environment, whatever the stimuli is. So whether it's a reaction to drugs or foods or stress, we do have a unique response. And sometimes it's similar to others, and sometimes it's very different. And so one of the continuing challenges of nutrition research is to understand and deal with the variability in response to nutrients.
Yes, and I'm pleased you keep mentioning the sort of idea of variability. It's because for so long we have assumed, or at least one's interpretation from much of the research out there is that, you know, that research is, you know, the outcomes of that research can be applied to everyone. And that isn't necessarily what they mean, because obviously conducting studies is a very difficult thing. You've got to control for as many variables as possible. But the one variable that you can't really control for, at least not at this point in time really, is one's genetics. And that is absolutely fascinating, particularly to me as a practitioner, this idea. And we'll discuss whether or not this actually realistically can be done yet or not. But the idea that particularly with elite athletes, I can take a look at a client, do my physiological testing, everything from body composition to performance tests, but also I could run some sort of genetic profile and understand just how likely it is my interventions are going to help them arrive at the outcomes that we're trying to achieve, which in some cases could be critical to them achieving their goals, particularly in a relatively short period of time. So that's referred to really as this idea of personalized nutrition, isn't it? And there's also personalized exercise programs, personalized medicine, but personalized nutrition is very much a golden chalice, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think just to give the listeners sort of a better, more of a background. Mm. So over the past 15 years or so, clinical researchers have identified many genetic variations that are associated with the response and metabolism of medications. For example, we have chemotherapy drugs for breast cancer that are found in some people to have zero effect, where they can be very effective in another person. And this would be a difference in their genotype. So obviously screening for this is very important when it comes to medicine. And the same for things like warfarin. Some dosages can be fatal in one person, yet that amount is necessary for effectiveness in another person. So basically, nutrigenomics is a branch of personalized medicine where we're seeing that nutrient requirements can be very different among individuals. So personalized nutrition is taking into account these differences so we can better prescribe diets that are going to suit that individual.
Yeah, and I like this idea that there's two sides to the coin here, of course. It's not just how what particular diet can have, you know, what particular effect. It's also, you know, how our own gene expression can influence the function of these things. I mean, we're super complex, and all. I mean, this really does make everything so much more complicated.
It does.
But you know, if we can just sort of go back a bit to some basics here, because I think it's one area that they don't teach a whole lot of for various reasons. I certainly didn't get much schooling on genetics. We talk about things like genotypes and phenotypes and that sort of thing. I mean, what are they talking about in that regard?
Well, a genotype is a genetic variation. And that's also, as I mentioned, SNPs. Mm. So basically, those are used interchangeably. And that, so we have 3 billion base pairs in our genome. We have about 25,000 genes. So it is very complex. But we have discovered about 10 million areas on the genome where we have these different differences, so genetic variations or genotypes or SNPs. And this can result in a different phenotype or a physical characteristic. So a phenotype can be a more muscular build compared to a leaner build, or it can be blue eyes compared to brown eyes, or it can be a fast metabolizer of caffeine versus a slow metabolizer of caffeine, and it goes on and on. So basically anything that we can measure is a physical characteristic. And so that's when we talk about phenotype. So we are trying to determine what are all the genetic variations that can be responsible for a certain phenotype. And this is it's a little bit more black and white in nutrition. And I know when it comes to exercise and the sport genomics, there are many factors that are involved when it comes to training and determining or predicting who's going to be an elite athlete. Mm. But as far as genotypes, we will have these genetic variations from birth to death. So basically, if you are less able to utilize vitamin C, you're not as efficient as metabolizing it, you need more vitamin C from your diet, you're going to have this genotype from birth to death. And the same goes for caffeine metabolism. If you're a slow metabolizer, which puts you at a higher risk for high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease, you're going to have this genotype from birth to death. And similar with how you respond to certain fats or to vitamin D or your ability to absorb iron. And again, the list goes on and on. And so these are certain factors that come into play over your lifetime when determining what is going to be the best diet for you. Whereas what's going to be the best exercise for you, we really don't know yet. The research is not there. It's at the early stages, but we really can't be prescribing training at this point, for example.
Yes, yeah, and we'll talk about that side of it, because that's sort of a dark, murky area that I think warrants a bit of discussion. But I mean, I love this idea that we potentially can now start to look at how nutrients affect gene function and how genetic variation affects nutrient response. You know, you've mentioned it there, different rates of absorption for, you know, different types of vitamins and minerals and other bioactive substances and so on. Our ability to synthesize substances will vary. You know, as you say, there are people that for genetic reasons are able or unable to interact with lactose. We know that people metabolize alcohol at different rates. And there's all sorts of stuff that we've learned. And I know that, I mean, this is worth saying, this is a big area for research. There are, I'm guessing at this point, but there's billions of dollars being pumped into genetics, clearly. Yeah. It's massive, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, and there are some opponents to it. And I think much of the controversy surrounding genetic testing services, for example, is because the relationship to disease risk has been of questionable clinical utility because of the genetic information that's been provided actually really hasn't panned out. Mm. So we have certain disease risk, let's say, for example, the BRCA1 gene, which shows what level of risk you have for breast cancer. And this was popularized, of course, by Angelina Jolie. And basically, you have 100% lifetime risk of getting breast cancer with this gene. However, there's little evidence to support the role for genetic testing for more common gene variants that are linked to complex chronic diseases such as obesity, heart disease, cancer. And the main reason that there has been this opposition is because the predictive power of common gene variants is very weak, and virtually all the studies linking these common genotypes to the risk of disease have yielded very inconsistent results across populations. And if they do have a positive result, it's a very small effect. Mm. And so, but in nutrigenomics, we're not trying to predict disease per se. It's more about how we can predict your response to nutrients, which may be involved in the nutrition related or the nutrition mediated risk of disease.
Yeah.
So I think that's where in the early stages, a lot of healthcare professionals are very skeptical in the ability to accurately predict chronic disease risk. But I think in my case, we're also moving more towards health, wellness, and performance. So we sort of are, you know, moving away from disease, although a lot of this will relate to athletes, for example, the risk of obesity. And we see that an intake, for example, of saturated fat and the risk of obesity for some genotypes is very high. Mm. And this has been well established by a researcher, Jose Ordova at Tufts, where there's now 5 or 6 studies in different populations showing if you have this genetic variation or genotype, you really have to keep a diet low in saturated fat. which is very different from, we know, a lot of the people following that low carb, high fat diet who are getting a benefit. But for those that have this genotype, and when it comes to athletes, athletes are very concerned about leanness and body composition. So this is a genetic variation which they would want to know more about.
Yeah.
So that's sort of where we can, you know, link the disease and bring it back to athletes and performance.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my problem with this is a lot of people tend to use this stuff, you know, for the purposes of it becomes an excuse that they can then hang their hat on. And whilst someone, and this is my interpretation, but whilst someone may have a genetic propensity to obesity, you've still got to be consuming an excessive amount of energy as it relates to the whole energy balance thing in order for that to become something that's beyond just a marginal issue. Now, I can see, you know, when we're talking about fine tuning, there can be some benefits when we start looking at how the body handles, you know, energy and nutrients and so on. But I kind of feel that one area that this is sort of going down the wrong path as people go, well, you know, I have a genetic propensity to gain body fat. Therefore, it's got nothing to do with the fact that I overeat. I'm just going to, you know, go and take these supplements sort of thing. And now that isn't the researcher's fault. That's just how people are interpreting this or how people are abusing what we're learning from this. But it is something that you hear. You hear people talk about how obesity is being defined as a disease, for example, because they can relate that to some potential genetic, you know,
propensity.
Yeah,
absolutely. And that's sort of a little bit different, that we find associations of certain genes to the risk of obesity. But there are definitely there's definitely a lot of research that shows that you can override that with physical activity. So it is a combination of lifestyle and your genetics. But genetics certainly aren't your destiny. Yeah. And lifestyle plays a huge role. But when it comes to your specific response to certain nutrients, this is something that will stick with you for a lifetime. And it's something to consider. So I know in previous podcasts, numerous times you've talked about marginal gains. And so maybe sleeping for an extra 30 to 60 minutes a night, or stretching after a workout, or having a good dose of protein before bed on a heavy strength training day. These might all be marginal gains, but they are going to be additive, and they are going to result in a moderate or major gain.
Yeah.
And aligning your diet with your DNA is one more way that we can have a marginal or maybe a higher than marginal gain.
Yeah.
And so it is definitely something to consider.
Yeah.
If you want to do the best for your body and get as close as you can to reaching your genetic potential, you do want to align your diet and in the future align your training with your genetic profile.
Yeah.
And so even though you have a risk of certain things and you can intervene with lifestyle, there are certain things that you definitely want to consider over the lifespan. And for example, if you have the genotype where you're very poor at absorbing iron and you're a female endurance athlete, throw on top of that your vegan, that's a real concern for your iron needs and your risk of anemia.
Yeah.
You know, and I think also it's, you know, in a nutshell, we want to investigate responders and non-responders. And when it comes to sport nutrition and ergogenic aids, I think this is where there's an opportunity to figure out what's happening in the research. And again, in podcasts where we talk about science being reported as averages, as means. And when I see a study of creatine, for example, and we see on average there's a small positive benefit, yet we had five outliers that had this huge improvement, as a researcher and as a practitioner, I want to know what happened with those five people. And I don't think it's good enough anymore to just say in your conclusion in your study, oh, there could be genetic differences.
Yeah.
We need to investigate and we need to find out what is happening on the individual level. And you well know, as a practitioner, you want prescribed diets or supplements or advice to that individual. So we need to know what is going on with that individual.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm with you there, Nancy. I mean, my whole my whole practice is all about customizing our interventions, and that's why I've got a lab.
That's right.
We've got our own lab, and believe me, we spend a huge amount of time and effort and money actually on buying the equipment to help us identify these things that enable us to create these personalized approaches. And I cannot wait for us to be able to go that extra level and look into genetics. So as a segue into that end of the discussion then, because I know that, you know, there's a huge amount of research out there, and especially in the whole medical area, but with things like alcohol and caffeine, which I know you have a particular area for, which we'll talk about more in a second, dietary fat, fruits and vegetables, certain micronutrients, as you mentioned, choline, vitamin C, folate, I can see huge issues with that, and women wishing to go pregnant, for example, that could really help a lot of heartache. There's all sorts of stuff, you know, that's there in the journals, in the papers, but how much of this, how much of this is really a reality?
Yeah, well, I think it's important when it comes to direct-to-consumer genetic tests, which, of course, we've seen various companies pop up on the internet. They've come and gone. There's been probably hundreds. Yeah. And those that have really been able to stick are those that have really stringent, rigorous scientific testing, and they have very robust science that's going to back up these tests, where you find a lot of these companies that are started by business people and not qualified researchers from the field, and they're trying to capitalize on this and make money. And you know, we won't name names. And they're really stretching the research. Mm. And so it is important that you go with a company that does have a good reputation, and you can look into the research behind it. And they're only using markers that have been replicated in distinct populations. And there have been large studies, most of which are often GWAS studies, and not have sort of questionable research where they're taking, and we see this all the time just with supplements, where they'll take a piece of the research, take it out of context, and then start selling the supplement saying that there's research behind it. And the same thing happens with genetic testing. So, I mean, there are definitely some rules and some things that you want to look for. Is the science being interpreted correctly? Who developed the test? Are the researchers qualified? And is it looking at disease-associated genes compared to modifier genes, things that modify your response to your diet? And also, are the results actionable? I mean, can we actually take this research and say, okay, you can change your diet, and this is the result you can expect? We are in the early stages, but, certainly there is some validity to this. And again, it depends what you're looking at.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the reason why I'm mentioning this is because, of course, one of the sort of hot topics right now is this idea of home testing kits that you will see, especially here in the UK, it has suddenly become really popular, where there's a number of brands that will provide you with a testing kit that often is retailed via a practitioner I use the word practitioner loosely, but but a personal trainer or some kind of nutritionist or something. And I'm not suggesting that they're necessarily registered or licensed, or, you know, these are just pretty much anyone that has that sort of basic goal of working with some sort of clientele to help their clients with things like health, fitness, body composition. But the end result often is sort of some sort of customized diet plan and supplement plan as a result of these testing. And what I'm gathering from what's being said, and maybe you can set me straight a bit, is that that's maybe where we're taking things a bit far. I mean, that's just what I'm thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, a lot of these companies are trying to sort of sensationalize the research and really stretch the research. And that's where it is important that this is led by science and it's not led by marketing and by hype and things like the blood type diet, you know, which made millions. And that's when we look back, the science was very broken. This, again, it is in the early stages, but there are some things that we can definitely implement to have an individual have a better response to their diet. I mean, right now, a lot of the dietary advice is based on sex and age. Mm. And so you're getting the same advice as tens of millions, hundreds of millions of other people.
Yeah.
And that's really not individual enough. And I think, again, we have to differentiate between what we can see in nutrition and what we can see with exercise. And there's also strong research, for example, with injury risk. And we do see that there's some genetic variations in genes that code for collagen formation. And that is very strong, that you have a increased risk of Achilles tendon rupture, for example, if you have this certain genotype. But when it comes to exercise, I think if you talk to some of the experts in the field, and again, it's a fairly small community around the world, but I think we're at the beginning of identifying genes that are associated with training, but we're definitely a long way from prescribing training based on genes. Mm. And certainly putting together a whole diet based on your genes, it is also a little bit of a stretch. I mean, it depends what the dietary recommendations are. So, I mean, we're sort of getting into specifics there. Hmm. But let's take it back to caffeine, for example.
Sure.
We know clearly that some people are more sensitive to caffeine. Some people are slow metabolizers, and they really have to be careful with their caffeine intake when it comes to heart health. And my research now is trying to look at various ways, about 25 genotypes that are associated with caffeine metabolism or response, and how this can affect athletic performance in various exercise tests. And that's sort of where we want to move toward when it comes to supplements, ergogenic aids, diets, and training. But the studies need to be done, and we need training studies. We need to be able to have an intervention and see an outcome. And I think right now, with a lot of the association studies, we can see that certain genotypes are associated with those that are elite power athletes versus those that are amateur or other controls. But a lot of these sample sizes are too small, and we really can't, we don't have conclusions on how someone should train or be able to predict if they're going to be a world-class athlete in their certain sport.
Yeah, and to bring it back to what we were saying at the beginning, I think this is going to be awesome, and it's research like yours that's going to be especially useful to us, because I know I have had quite a few athletes that have I've had the majority of athletes have been responders, but I've had some that have been non-responders to certain ergogenic aids like caffeine, beta-alanine, even creatine, and it would have been incredibly useful if I had had some sort of test or assessment that could have helped me determine the likelihood of that and maybe focused on another intervention that may have had a better outcome. And I think that that is fantastic.
Mm.
Can you just tell us a bit more then about the research areas that are being done in this that have, in your opinion, a great deal of strength and promise?
Sure. Yeah. When we look at, for example, caffeine, decades of research trying to figure out if caffeine is bad for your heart, if it's going to raise blood pressure. And the results were very inconsistent over decades of studies. And it wasn't until the populations were stratified by genotype where it became clear who was at risk and who wasn't. And so this is over the past decade, this is where this research has grown. And it has become very evident that your genetics are very involved, whether you have a risk or not to your heart. And so I think this is a good example where we do have solid research, and we see that this really clarifies the inconsistencies that we've seen in that area of research. And with my research, for example, again, looking at caffeine and seeing what is the genetic profile that's going to help predict what dose someone needs of caffeine. We're looking at various doses versus placebo. Who's most likely to get a benefit? What type of athlete? And what athletes might be at risk for adverse health effects? And we do know that there are negative consequences to caffeine ingestion for some people. But again, this is dependent on genotype. So as far as how this can help with athletes and or what is the current research right now? I think there's some really clear ones with, again, vitamin C. We know that antioxidants are important to prevent exercise-induced free radical damage. But then again, we know from studies with Keith Barr, who's been on your podcast, of course, that if we have too many antioxidants present during fasted training, for example, we're not going to get that PGC1 alpha gene expression, and therefore it's going to inhibit the mitochondrial biogenesis. So too little vitamin C can be harmful, and too much can also be harmful. So we would want to know what is the genotype of that athlete as far as their ability to utilize vitamin C. Is it impaired or is it normal? Yeah. And certainly many athletes are popping vitamin C pills thinking they need more of an antioxidant. And we know that this can be an impediment to the adaptations to training as far as mitochondrial biogenesis, for example. Yeah. And then as far as certain types of fats and body composition, we do have studies on saturated fat, on PUFAs, on MUFAs, and it is very clear, along with protein, that people do have individual responses that are going to be positive or negative when it comes to their body composition. And this, again, is just one of many factors, and we have to bring it back to those marginal gains. And excuse me, I think marginal gains can be additive. So an area of the future that I see as well is if we look at Oskar Zuckentrup's work with the amount of carbohydrates that we can metabolize, and for an endurance athletes, we used to think, of course, it was about 60 grams per hour. And now when we look at the glucose transporters and we add different sources of carbohydrates, this can be perhaps up to 90 grams per hour. But where we can bring this back to genotype is there are genetic variations in glucose transporters. So if you're maxed out for being able to transport glucose, perhaps in the future you're going to need a sport drink formulation that's going to need more fructose or other forms of carbohydrates, because your glucose transporters are not necessarily impaired, but they're at the lower end. And so this is sort of the future for sports nutrition. And you know, that's we have that research right now a little bit as it relates to diabetes, but a lot of this can be extrapolated and be translational science towards sport nutrition recommendations.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting times for sure. And I know that even though the years are ticking away, at least it feels that way. I know that in the not too distant future, I will, you know, as a practitioner in my day-to-day practice, I'm going to be able to get my hands on all this to help me individualize my clients. And I love that. I love that idea that we can get into some serious personalization and understand who's a responder and who's likely to not be a responder. Like you say, this person, actually, we need to pay a bit more attention to iron particularly because we also know in our needs analysis of this athlete that they're a vegetarian or a vegan. I think that stuff is going to be fantastic, and it will potentially become an essential tool for all of us practitioners.
Yeah, and you know, right now actually, we're just going to launch a company where a lot of the research in our lab helps develop genetic testing kits. So a company that I'm working with, we're just launching a new genetic testing kit for athletes. And we have many SNPs that aren't yet in the marketplace, and some interesting research around the psychological response to exercise. And so we're going also beyond nutrition, even though as far as this kit is concerned, it is focused on sport nutrition. And of course, as a sport dietitian, that is my focus. But I think you know, this is an example of a test kit that's come out of a major university and is funded by a major university. And I think that's the difference. When you're looking to shop around at genetic testing kits, you want to look at the background of that company. And I know that we do have definitely, we have to be careful of those pop-up internet companies and the ones that are offering too many tests. So yeah, if you can get 200 SNPs and it's telling you all kinds of things sort of beyond reason, that is something to be skeptical about.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just would like to sort of bring people back to looking behind some of these companies, because they are valid and there is opportunity to align our dietary advice with our DNA. And I think it really is the future of sport nutrition. And that's why I went back to school to study this, because yeah, I recognize it as an important tool in our toolbox as sport dietitians.
Absolutely. No doubt, Nancy. And I guess the other side of this is quite simply that this should be recognized as a complex tool in our toolbox. But in the same way a scalpel is a complex tool for a surgeon, perhaps this form of nutrigenomic testing is a complex tool that should be used or put into the hands of those that have a fairly decent minimal level of training and education, so that they know how to use this tool and how to apply it, such as, say, you know, sports dietitians or dietitians and, you know, registered sports nutritionists like we have in the UK and dietitians in the UK, sports scientists, that sort of thing. I think there comes a point where it's the right tool, but in the wrong hands. And that, again, is going to be where people get a bit crazy. Sometimes they get very negative about the testing, and it's not necessarily the testing, it's just being used by the wrong people.
Yeah, you're bang on. And this is the problem with direct-to-consumer and a lot of people that have no background that are trying to interpret the results. So we do need to have tests that ensure that the person providing the test has been trained and they do have a background and an understanding. And for example, the test that I was just talking about, we do have training for providers, and this isn't direct to consumer. And that way you can ensure that the individual's results are private, protected. Yeah. We can, you know, and there's accountability to that provider, and it's that provider can also prescribe the diet, and it's not left in the hands of the consumer, which can be very confusing. And it also, you're right, in the wrong hands. You know, some people are making changes that really the test, it wasn't warranted to make such changes. And really the information in that test was a stretch.
Yeah, because I think that there's all sorts of tests that are out there. But when you start talking about genetics, it sort of has a sort of a gold standard sort of feel to it, doesn't it? It's in the genetics. It's sort of Watson and Crick said so. So we're, you know, they're dishing out, yeah, Nobel Prizes for this stuff. So if my genetic test says I should eat paleo, then maybe that's what I should do.
Well, you know what else is interesting is there's also research, again, that has come out of our lab that shows that people who have their DNA information are motivated to make dietary changes.
Yeah.
And we know that one of the biggest hurdles in nutrition is behavioral change.
Yeah.
So, and I know from clients that I've used genetic testing with, they read their results and they know they can't fly under the radar of the general recommendations to cut back on sodium, eat more fruits and vegetables. This information is particular to them, and it certainly is a motivator. And we've now seen this in the research that people are more motivated when they know their genetic information as it relates to nutrition and what changes they need to make on a personal level. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, in my own experience, when I was opening up my report, my heart rate was elevated because this clearly pertains to me and to me only.
Yeah.
And that really, you know, that's a step up in the motivation to make the changes.
Absolutely. I mean, I, you know, folks can read this eventually, but in my own doctoral thesis, you know, one of the areas that I've been writing up recently is this conclusion from my own practice is the, you know, diagnostic testing isn't just about the value that the diagnostics can provide from a data perspective, but it's how useful they are to help drive behavior. And I have certainly observed substantially increased compliance in clients when some form of test is involved. And
absolutely,
that is an awesome thing. But also, again, that's where it kind of gets abused. So let's just move direction slightly a bit, because I think it's worth us discussing a bit about what the skeptics might say. So, you know, you must, in your, as a researcher, of course, you must be aware of what the opposition is saying about this stuff. I mean, what sort of skepticism are you actually coming across with this? You know, why are people not buying into it?
Well, interestingly, I think in the area of research, I think a lot of research have a fear of the unknown, and they don't understand genetics, and they would rather sort of leave that out when they're researching various interventions. So I think from the research perspective, we have to get people more comfortable with looking at genotyping and affiliating themselves with a lab that does it, collaborating with a university or a lab that is familiar and experienced in genetic testing. And I think this really should be a part of research. And I think it'll be more widely acceptable when it is sort of a part of presenting the whole picture. So when I look at research now and they haven't included any sort of genotyping, and they have an outcome that is sort of across the board, responders and non-responders, whatever the intervention may be, I really don't think we're seeing the whole picture. So I think where practitioners and scientists and consumers and athletes are going to feel more comfortable is that when we do build a greater foundation of research, and we are at the early stages, however, we do have enough research at this point that can benefit athletes, and it can help you with your body composition and your various sport goals and to be healthier. And as you've mentioned many times, you're a human first and you're an athlete second. And if you're not a healthy human, you really can't be an elite athlete. And so I think a lot of the research right now that's based on health is a good starting point. But in the future, we're going to need these performance studies. And I think that is what is the demand of the skeptics, that we don't have enough research that shows, okay, if we are doing an intervention based on genotype, if we are changing your diet based on genotype, show me that this is giving my athlete a performance benefit. Show me that this athlete is healthier. And we do have some evidence when we look more at studies in the general population when it comes to weight loss. When we look at genotype and we have people put on certain diets and we can see that there's a gene-diet interaction and some people are having more of a benefit off a certain diet type, high protein, low protein, high fat, whatever it may be. So I think We're building on that. But a lot of the skeptics, I think, need to keep up to date with the current research, what we're doing, and be open-minded to what we have and where we're going with this. Yeah. And everything that's new in research across the board, you will have your skeptics. You will have people that are in opposition because it's change. And there's a lot of change. And I think this is genetic testing and this whole field is going at a very rapid pace. And I think a lot of people are concerned, to a large part, I think, because they don't have a deeper understanding.
Sure. Yeah. And, you made a point there, which is something that Professor Kevin Tipton, who's been on this podcast quite a few times, and I've been very lucky to sit through lots of his lectures in the flesh, so to speak. And one thing that he constantly goes on about is the importance of, you know, the quality of evidence, etc. But at the end of the day, we as scientists or practitioners, yes, we should be skeptical, but we should also be open-minded. And being skeptical and open-mindedness is a very difficult thing to do, but it is essential. And you know, we see on the internet, social media, etc., a hell of a lot of battles going on by people who support one view or another, but very few people tend to be, you know, they can be skeptical, but they're not necessarily open-minded, and they're just not evaluating all of the data, and they themselves have some sort of bias for whatever reason. So that's why I like doing this podcast, because we can unpack the evidence and explore it a bit. And you said it before I did, but it is always about context.
Yes, that's right.
So look, listen, we're out of time actually. So we've gone through so much. I keep promising the listeners, and it is going to happen, but I will have a page per podcast soon. And we'll certainly have links to your research and other things that you feel is relevant to this podcast on that particular page. But how can folks in the meantime learn more about you? I know you have a Twitter and a website. Do you just want to share what they are quickly?
Sure. Yeah. My Twitter, that's probably where I'm most active. It's Nancy with an I. So Nancy Guest, my last name, RD. So Nancy Guest RD. I do have another Twitter page, Pan Am Dietitian, but that I'll probably be closing down since those games are over. And there is a link to my website on my Twitter page. My website is still under construction. as you know, building content is very consuming. And right now, running a business, doing my PhD, it's a busy time. Yeah. But that's probably the best way on Twitter. And certainly, I would be open to answering more questions.
Great.
And getting people excited about this. Because I think there is really a strong future. And we are going to, everyone is going to have their whole genome sequenced, and we're going to know many things about our environment and gene interactions in the future.
Absolutely, and I'm excited. I'm excited about what the future holds, but like we just said, you know, we still need to exercise some skepticism with an open mind. Look, thank you, Nancy. It's been awesome with you. Good luck with finishing up your PhD. I know you're at that tail end of data collection and then the whole writing up thing. And when you've published your final research, we'll definitely get you back on to discuss all that a bit further. But that brings us to the end of this podcast, number 64, on Nutri Genomics with Nancy Guest. As I mentioned at the beginning, the podcast is in association with HealthSpan Elite, who produce evidence-based nutritional products, which are assessed by Informed Sport. And you can learn more about that at healthspanelite.co.uk. You can learn more about the podcast and other activities at Guru Performance at guruperformance.com. Of course, you can learn about all sorts of things relating to sports and exercise nutrition via the International ISSN Diploma program, which is at issndiploma.com, and or you can come learn about sports nutrition with me at the MSc in sports nutrition that I run at Middlesex University. So that brings us to the end. As I said, I of course am Laurel Bannock and look forward to bringing another podcast back to you all very soon. And thanks again, Nancy.
Thanks, Laurel. Have a great day.
Okay.